From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After September 11th, the Justice Department cracked down on illegal immigrants from predominantly Muslim countries. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Cam Simpson and Flynn McRoberts about their investigative series for the Chicago Tribune, Tossed Out of America. Also, as promised, more of our interview with actor Peter Sarsgaard. He's starring in Shattered Glass. His other films include Boys Don't Cry, K-19 The Widowmaker, and Dead Man Walking. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews several network specials marking the 40th anniversary of JFK's assassination. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In a speech in London today, President Bush defended the war in Iraq and said the U.S. will not be forced out by attacks against U.S. troops and Iraqi civilians. NPR's Don Gagne reports from London.
The president, addressing a military think tank at Whitehall Palace in central London, said that war should always be a last resort, but that it should be pursued if needed when diplomacy fails.
The people have given us the duty to defend them. And that duty sometimes requires the violent restraint of violent men. In some cases, the measured use of force is all that protects us from a chaotic world ruled by force.
The president also talked about the Middle East, including blunt words for Israel. He said erecting walls and fences through the West Bank only humiliates the Palestinians living there. He also said Palestinians need to do more to crack down on terrorists. Don Gagne, NPR News, London.
A senior U.S. commander in Iraq said today that his forces have arrested two Iraqi men suspected of planning to shoot down U.S. aircraft with missiles. Lieutenant Colonel Steve Russell said the men and one other man who's not yet been found are suspected of plotting to attack the aircraft in the area around Tikrit, the hometown of ousted dictator Saddam Hussein. The state of Illinois is overhauling its laws related to capital punishment. Bill Wheelhouse reports from WUIS in Springfield.
The Illinois legislature has signed off on changes to the state's death penalty system. They include safeguards designed to improve the capital punishment process, which came under scrutiny after the exoneration of more than a dozen death row inmates in recent years. The new law will make it harder to sentence someone to death if testimony came from a jailhouse informant. Defendants will have more access to DNA evidence, and judges will have more leeway to commute a death sentence to life in prison. The reforms in Illinois come after former Governor George Ryan earlier this year commuted the death sentences of more than 150 inmates sitting on death row. The current governor says he'll continue a moratorium until it's proven the new safeguards work. For NPR News, I'm Bill Wheelhouse in Springfield, Illinois.
Investigators from the U.S. and Canada say last summer's blackout in the Midwest and Northeast could have been prevented. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham says the massive outage began with line failures in Ohio.
The blackout was initiated when three high-voltage transmission lines operated by First Energy Corporation short-circuited and went out of service when they came into contact with trees that were too close to the lines.
The joint U.S.-Canadian investigation found First Energy should have contained the failures that eventually affected 50 million people. In stocks today, the Dow gained 66 points to close at 9,690. The Nasdaq gained 18 points. This is NPR News. In Chicago, 33,000 public school teachers have voted to approve a new contract, averting a possible December strike. Katrin Einhorn reports from Chicago Public Radio.
The contract passed, but not by much. Only 55% of teachers voted in its favor. Chicago Teachers Union President Deborah Lynch says she negotiated a good contract considering the economic times, but Lynch says she understands why teachers are still frustrated.
Our members have legitimate concerns about the salary and benefits, legitimate concerns about the retention of good teachers in Chicago rather than having the brain drain to the more competitive suburbs.
Lynch also attributes the close vote to what she calls misinformation about the the pension fund and confusion about health insurance. Teachers have worked without a contract since July 1st. Chicago Public Schools serve 440,000 students. 85% of them come from low-income families. For NPR News, I'm Katrin Einhorn in Chicago.
Authorities in Southern California say pop star Michael Jackson will be charged with child molesting. Santa Barbara Sheriff Jim Anderson says the singer has been asked to turn himself in and give up his passport.
Mr. Jackson's been given an opportunity to surrender himself to the custody of the Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department within a specified period of time. We are currently working with Mr. Jackson's legal representation on this matter.
A spokesman for Jackson said the allegations were outrageous and totally unfounded. Jackson was accused of sexually abusing a child in 1993, but that case ended after Jackson agreed to a multi-million-dollar settlement. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 18 points, or nearly 1%, to close at 1,899. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sundance Channel. This month, Anatomy of a Scene explores the making of The Cooler, starring William H. Macy. Listings at sundancechannel.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As part of its efforts to prevent future terrorist actions, the Justice Department has been cracking down on illegal immigrants from predominantly Muslim countries. The Chicago Tribune has just published a three-part series on that campaign called Tossed Out of America. According to this report, ever since September 11th, deportation orders have greatly increased for unauthorized immigrants from predominantly Muslim countries, while illegal immigrants from other nations face no extra scrutiny. My guests are two of the three reporters who wrote this investigative series, Cam Simpson and Flynn McRoberts. As part of their investigation, they followed one of the six planes that carried deported Pakistanis to Islamabad. The reporters found that the deportations have ruptured families, separating men from wives and children, and increased fear within Muslim communities in America. Simpson, who covers the Justice Department for the Tribune, says that the biggest immigration program the department put into place in the wake of September 11th was the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, which was rolled out by the Attorney General in June 2002. It required Islamic men who were in the U.S. as foreign visitors to register with the American government. There were two components to the system.
When it came to registering people at the border, it was kind of a secondary check for people, and they said they could use intelligence criteria at the border based on travel and based on, you know, what country someone was coming from, how they purchased their ticket, their answers to specific questions. And that was an early rollout, they said, of a system that Congress mandated for all foreign visitors to the United States. But they then created a very separate and distinct domestic registration for people who were already in the country from 24 predominantly Muslim nations, and then also added North Korea into the mix. And the statutory underpinning of that was indeed quite different. The effect was quite different. It dealt with people who, you know, were living here already and had lives, and many of whom had families. And it ended up affecting, there were about 83,000 men who came in to register in a window that started in November and ended November of 2002 and ended in April of this year. And once those people came in, of course, anyone who was viewed as having potential violations of immigration laws were put into deportation proceedings. And that's about almost 14,000 people.
So who was required to register under that regulation?
All men from those countries. It was just purely based on nationality, which the Justice Department says, you know, we realize it was a blunt instrument, but they felt like they didn't have any choice. So it was just men, and it was just, again, based on nationality. That was the only criteria for the domestic registration.
This registration program was very controversial within Islamic American communities. And many people said that, you know, it's best to hide or to not register. And other people said, no, the consequences will be terrible if you don't register. And other people said, no, what's a patriotic thing to do? One should register. Do you know if most of the people who were supposed to register did, in fact, do it?
In Muslim enclaves around the United States, whether it was Devon Avenue in Chicago, Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn, Dearborn, Michigan, where there are a lot of Arab Americans, there were community leaders who felt like, especially in the wake of 9/11, after there was so much hatred directed towards them and their neighbors, that this registration was a way to, in effect, prove their patriotism, prove that they're law-abiding Americans. And so they held seminars, they rented out hotel ballrooms, they went on ethnic radio and said, it is your legal obligation to register with the government. You must do it, and if you don't do it, you will be deported. So many families did so. They complied, and they were soon found out that by doing so, they were very likely to have their husbands, their sons, their family members detained and often deported. And this, of course, it only took a few experiences like this down at the immigration offices in Chicago or New York or wherever for the word to get back in the neighborhood that, if you know, this is a real risk. If you go down there, your husband might be sent back to Karachi or to Lahore or to Islamabad. Many of families fled to Canada or back to Pakistan last winter when this registration occurred. Now there's a second registration on the second anniversary, and the fear is that there'll be another run for the border and a run for flee from America.
Who's required to register this time around?
The same men. If you have to go in. If you registered, say, January 10th of 2003, you must come back at January 10th, 2004, and register again.
It was like a renewal.
Exactly. And again, another, as Cam indicated earlier, another opportunity for the government to deport these people.
What have the criteria been for who to deport, who among those who registered to deport?
Well, they ended up having, you know, a very exacting look at, you know, the status of each one of these people who came in. It turned out, you know, to be an individualized review of more than 80,000 cases. So I think, you know, the government has said the vast majority of these people who are now in deportation proceedings through these programs, through this registration specifically, are straight visa overstays. And you know, they are also encouraging most of these people in these proceedings to take what's known as voluntary departure. It's kind of an immigration plea bargain, but the end result is the same, and that is, you know, you're forced out of the country. It's the government says, you know, its primary motivation in doing this is that it saves money in terms of deporting people. So, you know, we did not get a look at each of these 13,000 cases, but I think the vast majority of them are just people who have remained for whatever period of time inside the United States on expired visas.
And one thing we point out as well is that, you know, because I think many readers, and we've already gotten feedback from people that said, hey, these people stayed, you know, broke the law, they stayed, overstayed their visa, you know, what's your problem? The point we try to make, though, is that these men are doing the precise thing that roughly 8 million Mexicans, Irish, Polish, Bosnians are doing this in the United States. The only reason they're not being deported is because they're not men from predominantly Muslim countries. So there's a basic fairness issue that even though America has always treated its foreign visitors differently than its citizens, this still gets at some basic American values such as, you know, equal justice and freedom and, you know, rights of individuals that many people find troubling.
But let me ask you, even if there is a double standard and even if proportionately more Islamic men are being deported than illegal immigrants from other religions or nationalities, couldn't you argue that, oh, of course, I mean, because it's people from predominantly Muslim countries that are attacking the United States?
Sure, and you know, we've heard that from the government, and we've heard that from readers, and certainly you know, some, you can make that argument. But when you kind of look at the overall approach, what you see is it's a giant search for a needle in a haystack. You know, we point out that there have been no public terrorism charges out of this domestic registration, more than 83,000 people that they looked at. Government said it did find a handful of men, although it won't say how many that had unspecified ties to terrorism. Does it make sense if you want to finally tighten the porous immigration system in the U.S. to deal with people from these countries first? That's one of the arguments. But overall, there's no plan to expand this process to everybody else when it comes to the domestic registration, the domestic measures. So does it make sense on its surface? It might. Has it been an efficient way to find or discourage terrorism? I think that's another question entirely. And as we've known for quite some time, Al-Qaeda is, you know, the most adaptive enemy that probably the United States has ever faced. And they quickly and easily find ways around things like this that get thrown up in their way.
Weren't a couple of the September 11th hijackers here on expired visas?
Yeah, there were three, actually, whose visas had expired by the time the attacks took place. But, you know, even the Attorney General himself, when he was asked, when he rolled this out, would this have made a difference? He said, well, you know, I don't know, I can't say. The only way that this could have made a difference is if we had a system in place, which we still don't have in place, whereby everyone with a visa that expires is picked up immediately by authorities, held in jail without bond until they're deported. Otherwise, you know, I don't think anything that we have in place would have made a difference. Now, one of the guys who was here on an expired visa, and what might have made a difference, was intelligence. The CIA, as it's been reported, you know, numerous times since September 11th, had real specific information about two of the key hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Mihdhar, and knew that one of them had a multi-entry visa to the United States and knew that the other one was in fact in the United States, and one was listed under his own name in the San Diego phone book. But that information was never shared until, I think, August 23rd of 2001 with people who could have made a difference. So they were able to get and keep visas and in fact get a visa renewed because of the system outside the border, the system where we vet people and decide who can get a visa and who can't. So when there was very specific information, instead of kind of this really broad net, needle in a haystack approach, you know, we did not take advantage of it. And that's probably substantively much more important.
My guests are journalists Cam Simpson and Flynn McRoberts. They co-wrote the Chicago Tribune's investigative series, Tossed Out of America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Cam Simpson and Flynn McRoberts. They're two of the three reporters who wrote an investigative series for the Chicago Tribune on the U.S. crackdown against Muslims who are living in the United States as illegal aliens. One of the things that you did for your series was follow a plane load of Pakistani men who were being deported to Pakistan as a result of this crackdown. What are some of the stories you learned about some of the men on this charter flight who were deported, some of the reasons that they were deported?
You know, there were people on the charter flight who were deported and would have been deported even without September 11th, people who were convicted of crimes that made them deportable. But we did find certainly plenty of people who were picked up through the specific programs that we were writing about. And one of the most interesting cases was the case of Suleiman Faki, and Flynn certainly is in a good position to address that.
Suleiman Faki was 22 years old when he was when there was a pounding on the door of their apartment in Queens, and there were federal agents who wanted to talk to the family, and his older brother let them in, and the agents went into Suleiman's bedroom. It was before dawn, so he was still asleep, and they put a flashlight in his face and yelled at him to get up, let's go. And that was literally, literally and figuratively waking Suleiman from his American dream, which was that he assumed until that moment that he was legal. He thought this was all a terrible mistake, and that by the end of the day he'd be back in his family's house in Queens. What he didn't know is that his parents, when he was a kid, had filed a political asylum application. And it had been denied, and they refiled it to try to get another bite at the apple, and just used his mother's last name instead of his father's last name. This, you know, was fraud, and now someone had to pay for it, and the family recognizes that they messed up. They're just heartbroken that it's the baby of the family who grew up in the United States and literally used to belt out the national anthem to his family in the living room and played, you know, youth football and became a big Aerosmith fan and hip-hop fan. I mean, the kid is, you know, he sounds like Queens, he walks like Queens, and now he is in Karachi, and this is not a city that welcomes Americans or even ethnically Pakistani people who sound like America.
So have you kept up with him? Do you know what he's doing now?
He is living with his a cousin in Karachi, where his mother's family is. His mother was deported as well because she had filed a false political asylum application on his behalf. He has no job. He's hoping, at this point, against hope, that he will return to the United States and return to the cell phone store that he and his cousin opened on the Upper West Side of Manhattan just 3 weeks before the agents came into his room.
You write that many families have been separated because of these new deportations, because in many instances it's the man who's deported while the rest of his family, wife and children, remain in the States. Can you describe how that's working?
Yeah, it's, again, I mean, the registration program focused on men. So what you end up with is you have a man who's married, and in some cases even to a U.S. citizen, who has children who are born here, who are U.S. citizens, and, you know, the breadwinner in the family is the one who has to go back. And Flynn can talk a little more about kind of some specific cases. There was one, the 76 passenger on the flight that we looked at, who was pulled off at the last minute because he kind of had this devil's bargain of staying or going.
Yeah, his name was Mohammed Junaid, and he was, again, as Cam said, supposed to be the 76th passenger, but a Pakistani embassy official called his wife. They were doing courtesy calls, essentially saying, just so you know, your husband's being sent back to Islamabad tomorrow. If you want to, you know, save him, you've got 24 hours, essentially. And so that call came to an apartment in Queens, in Nishat Islam. Junaid's wife answered it. She was 6 months pregnant with their second U.S. citizen child. And she made panic calls to his lawyer and managed to get him off the plane. But he was then, of course, sent back to a county jail in New Jersey, where he had to wait for his hearing. So he was set. He was then faced with this wrenching decision: either can maintain my family's slim hopes of staying in the United States by staying behind bars and appealing my case, or dropping my appeal and going back to Pakistan. Eventually, he chose the latter, and on October 11th, he was deported. It was 2 days after he had gotten the first look at his new son, who had been born just, again, a couple days prior. And his wife now is faced with almost a sort of Sophie's Choice decision, where she finally found a job at a donut shop. It pays $6.50 an hour. It is not enough money to support two children and pay rent and pay food and clothing. So is once Rasha, the boy, who's a few weeks old now, once she has weaned Rasha, she is going to put him on a plane like his father was put on a plane and send him back to Pakistan, so because she cannot afford to raise two kids.
For families who are left behind after the husband or the brother has been deported, what options do the families have? I think once you're deported, you're never allowed back in the country. Is that right?
It's typical. Most of these guys, and correct me if I'm wrong, Cam, most of these guys face a 10-year ban, and you can get a waiver. There's some, and if you're sponsored by a close family relative, then it's a shorter wait. But in many of these cases, for instance, Mohammed Junaid's wife, she is a visa overstay as well, so she's basically waiting for a knock on the door.
So she thinks she'll be deported too.
Absolutely, and Suleiman Faki's family, for instance, his father is likely to be deported because even though he had not filed that application with the application for asylum that sent his wife and his youngest son back to Pakistan, authorities are looking at whether he participated in that fraud, and so he may go back.
I think, you know, there are some forms of relief they can try to apply for, but in reality, The vast, vast majority of these people are never going to get back in the country. Even people who ultimately end up getting what the government calls voluntary departure, which is kind of the self-deportation, it looks better on paper. They have a chance to apply again for a visa, but I don't think anyone realistically expects that that they're going to get a visa, because the violation, you know, still shows up that they were in deportation proceedings. It's I think it's pretty grim for the vast majority of these people, the chance of them ever getting back into the country.
What questions do you think that this crackdown raises about the balance between security and civil liberties, and particularly of the civil liberties of people who aren't yet even citizens?
You know, I think that you hit the question right on the head, and the question is the balance. And one thing that we found, and one thing that other people have raised as, you know, possibly being a detriment in the future, is the backlash effect. And, you know, while the story is little known inside the United States, these guys are front page news in Pakistan and other places like Pakistan. And, you know, there's tremendous amount of anti-Americanism already in those places, and we found that this was just kind of feeding into it. You know, people knew specifically about what was happening. They knew specifically that people from their nation were being singled out because they were from their nation. And it really feeds into this notion, the propaganda notion overseas, that, you know, the U.S. is anti-Islam or the U.S. is out to get all Muslims, and that's very difficult. I don't know how those questions get answered. And it also has created, you know, a backlash in these communities. One of the fears is that people in these neighborhoods are the very people who, if there's another September 11th, people like the neighborhood in San Diego where some of the hijackers lived, who might have information, who might be able to help, are they going to be so afraid of the government because of what's happened, that, and are they so alienated that they're not going to give us any information that might be helpful? So those are the big questions that are out there, and they're also kind of the intangible questions that are difficult to address. But I think, you know, hopefully now at least people have information, and they can start to look at what's happening and what the results have been, and they can weigh for themselves whether or not this is the best way to be spending our resources.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Cam Simpson and Flynn McRoberts are reporters for the Chicago Tribune. Their investigative series, Tossed Out of America, concluded yesterday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Warner Home Video and JFK, two-disc special edition, a film by Oliver Stone, including Beyond JFK, The Question of Conspiracy, now available. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, part two of our interview with actor Peter Sarsgaard. He stars in the new movie Shattered Glass. In Boys Don't Cry, he played a killer. In Dead Men Walking, he played a murder victim. Also, David Bianculli reviews several of the network specials marking the 40th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier this week, we featured a short interview with Peter Sarsgaard about his starring role in the new movie Shattered Glass. Sarsgaard plays Charles Lane, the editor of the magazine The New Republic. We're going to hear the rest of the interview, in which we talked about Sarsgaard's other roles and his approach to acting. He got his start in Dead Men Walking and co-starred in K-19. His breakthrough performance was in Boys Don't Cry, which was based on the true story of Tina Brandon, a young woman with a sexual identity crisis who moved to a new town, dressed as a boy, fell in love with another woman, and was killed by the woman's jealous ex-boyfriend. Sarsgaard played that boyfriend, John Lorder. In this scene, John and his ex-girlfriend Lana are at a birthday party for Tina Brandon, who is now using the name Brandon Tina. John is not only jealous, he suspects that Brandon Tina isn't what he says he is. As they watch Lana dance, John sits down next to Brandon and puts his arm around Brandon in a half-affectionate, half-menacing way.
She's beautiful, isn't she? Oh, man. I know, since she was like this high. I could tell you stories about her. You know, kind of stories. She told me about you guys. And I can't think of a better guy to give Lana to than you, so happy birthday!
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, it was just one thing. You gotta remember, little man, is this is my house.
Come on, turn up the music! Turn up the music!
Later in the film, John Lorder rapes and murders Brandon Tina. I asked Sarsgaard about portraying such a menacing and unlikable character.
I remember reading a story about John Lorder before we started. It was about... He was being taken to a reform school by his mother, and he was going along the highway. And, you know, I don't know how fast they're going, but he really, really did not want to go to reform school, and he was very, very close with his mother. And he was very upset, and he jumped out of the car as the car was moving because he wanted to be with his mother so badly. And that, I think that was a very significant story to me when I heard about it. And that's not so much playing someone as, because his life is so different than mine, something like that sort of allows me to love him, you know, which is what you have to do with those characters.
Well, empathy is so important when you're acting, but when you're, it's, I imagine it's hard to find empathy for somebody who's not a good person.
Yeah. I mean, you know, your director really helps you in that situation because they, on that movie, Kim Pierce, the director, made me feel like, she made me feel like a stud and the sheriff of the town, that I was a kind of law enforcement, you know, albeit my law, which was had some kindness to it. Like, I did not want to mete out the punishment. It was not something that I felt like I was being forced to do it, which is, you know, a kind of psychology that Kim just worked over on me, you know, and a good director will do that. They'll just start seeing the world through your eyes with you, you know, like over your shoulder, going, look at this new guy who came into town and is now your girlfriend, ex-girlfriend is all over him. This is the woman who is the only person that wrote letters to John Lotter when he was in jail. And, you know, really his only connection to the real loving world that we all know. And so, you know, at first my bad feelings toward Brandon Tina in that movie have nothing to do with the fact that it's a woman dressed as a man, or, you know, it really has to do with the fact that a very small man that looks like I could beat up is taking my ex-girlfriend from me.
I know some people who didn't see Boys Don't Cry because they didn't think they could sit through what they knew was coming, which was that she, you know, that Brandon Tina, Tina Brandon gets beaten, gets raped, gets killed. Can you talk about what it was like to do those difficult scenes?
Yeah, I mean, it can be very technical some of the time. I mean, you're obviously... My main concern doing those scenes is that I don't hurt the other person. And so frequently, you know, I've been on both sides of violent scenes in movies, and I always prefer to be on the receiving end because you don't have to worry, you know. The main problem in doing them is that you want it to look real. You want it to, because the fake version of that, I think, is kind of socially irresponsible. But so you want it to have a sense of reality, but you also don't want to hurt your co-star. So that's mainly what's going through my mind a lot of the time. And because of that, it's hard to indulge all of the animal instinct stuff that comes up in you while you're doing it, you know. You need to have people there that know what they're doing and give you all the equipment you need. I mean, in terms of doing a rape scene, you have to figure out logistically what you're doing, you know. I mean, it's the kind of stuff nobody talks about, but it's like you have to take down your pants, because people do when they do it, and that will not look real for the movie. And presumably she wouldn't have hers on, but then we don't want, you know, it's uncomfortable. And so you, in that movie, we actually put a dam in at one point to try to, you know, just to have something literally from me to hit when I was raping her. So it's incredibly, I mean, when I'm talking about it in that way that's so detailed, you can understand how it's not just doing a rape scene. It's like a whole logistical thing with people's feelings and people's bodies and trying to take care of everyone.
Did you find yourself apologizing to Hilary Swank because you had to treat her rough in the scenes?
I didn't, no. I didn't, because it seemed like the amount that it was upsetting her was not an amount that was going to affect her life, you know, like how, you know, her daily life as she went out, but that it might be good in the scene. And, you know, after we finished the movie, she and I, you know, patted each other on the back, and I congratulated her on her Academy Award and everything and felt so good about it. And we're friends now. But while we were doing it, if I had apologized each time after I did a take or something, I mean, it's... Then I'm not John Lauder, and she's, you know, it makes her job harder, I think.
My guest is Peter Sarsgaard. He's starring in the new movie Shattered Glass. Your first film role, I think this was your first role, was in Dead Man Walking.
Yeah.
What was your part in the role? I should say.
I was the boy who was raped and murdered. The reason Sean Penn goes to death row, he rapes and murders my girlfriend and I. So, yeah, that was another rape scene. I'd been on the receiving end, say, from that movie.
Well, did that help, having been on the receiving end in a movie?
Absolutely. How? Absolutely. Well, because I knew doing Boys Don't Cry and doing the rape scenes and everything that, you know, Hillary, who's the victim in that scene, once as an actor, for that all of this effort that you're going through, and it's physical and it's emotional and it's all these different things, that if you're only going to do it halfway, it's really almost as hard as doing it the whole way. And that you really might as well go all out, you know, because we don't need to see sort of how it happens in movies. Isn't it going to be more effective and more informative in our lives if we see closer to how it might really happen? And, you know, Sean Penn always errs on the side of it might really happen, you know. So, and Sean very much took care of me and Missy Yeager, who played the girl in that scene. I mean, the next day everyone got us massages and everything. And I mean, it was... That scene was very elaborate also, because we got thrown down in the mud and then raped and murdered. But obviously, to do another take, we had to go take showers, get dried off, put on makeup and our clothes, and go do it again from being dry and not muddy, because we were filming in the bayou in Louisiana. So, you know, that scene went on all night, you know.
So did being like really tired as the night wore on help in looking like a scared and under attack young man?
Yeah, I mean, I think it helped actually wear me down. I think takes probably 1 through 4 were unusable because I'd never been in a movie before. So I actually, the energy that I had from just having a camera pointed at me and acting with Sean Penn and doing all of this, it was probably too much, you know. So by the 8th take, I'm sure it was just
they had to beat
more
you
reasonable.
Down
right. It was more reasonable. It was like the Stanley Kubrick style. Beat the actor down until they just will do it.
My guest is actor Peter Sarsgaard. He's now starring in the film Shattered Glass. He plays Charles Lane, the editor of The New Republic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Peter Sarsgaard. He's now starring in the film Shattered Glass. You were an English and history major at Washington University. What had you planned on doing when you were in college?
I wanted to be a writer, actually. One of the reasons I went to Washington University was because Stanley Elkin, a very great short story writer and novelist, was teaching there. And I, you know, was just a huge fan. And so I got to meet Stanley, and I actually performed his short story, Poetics for Bullies, which is in the Criers, Kibitzers, Kibitzes, and Criers collection. And then it turned out William H. Gass was teaching there, who's also an incredible thinker and novelist. And Howard Nemirov was there at the time, and I just became sort of like, I don't know that I learned anything from any one of these guys except just to be around people that were just so fully committed to something so specific. You know, that Stanley's writing is so specific, and he did it his entire life.
Well, Stanley Elkin had MS, and toward the end of his life, he was, you know, very, very, very sick and had lost a lot of physical functioning. What was it like to be around somebody who was both your mentor but was very disabled at the same time?
Well, you know, he's in a wheelchair. I mean, you never know with Stanley, because I mean, he sort of made humor out of bile, you know. I mean, which is like a lemonade out of lemons. I mean, I remember one of his stories. It's about a guy in a wheelchair who has to go to the bathroom, and his wife leaves him right as he has to go to the bathroom, and he has to figure out how to go to the John. And that's how the story starts. So Stanley always had, like, a great deal of humor about his circumstances, I think, and just a keen, keen wit, and that's something that no disease could kill in you.
Why did you abandon the idea of writing?
A combination of I wasn't sure I was very good at it, and also, it's not sitting alone writing is not in my personality. You know, I very much need someone to say action and cut. I need people to make me do what I do for a living. I have a whole team of people that send me scripts and make sure I read them and ask me questions about them. And then you work with a director who you want to serve, and I work better when there's a group that I can disappoint. You know, if I were writing, the only person I could disappoint would be myself, and I'm too willing to do that.
Oh, you'd have an editor you could disappoint.
Oh, okay, great. Assuming
you've
I was
just
any
played
kind
one of those
writer.
Editors.
Yeah.
So what led you to acting?
Well, at first, a little bit randomly, I just started doing plays in college, and then this program that's at the New School, the Actor Studio program, mm-hmm. had kind of a satellite program. I think it was before they even started it at the New School. And Shelley Winters and Ellen Burstyn came down and, you know, taught for a bit, and Carlton Collier and all these people that are studio people came down, and they wanted non-actors, you know, people who are not in the theater department, because, you know, I think there's a little bit in the actor studio, there's a little bit of this idea that the best actors are going to be the ones who didn't want to be actors or something. You know, there's some sort of, it's a romanticization of what it means to be an actor, you know. We found this guy kind of thing. And so I was drawn to it just because I wanted to meet famous people. And I, you know, this class in particular. And I was very influenced by the ideas because it's sort of a somewhat intellectual way into acting, you know. I liked the idea behind it.
Now, you said you got into acting in part because you wanted to meet famous people. Now that you've met and worked with a lot of famous people, is meeting famous people still of any interest?
Meeting people that are... It's I would say not meeting famous people, but meeting people that I respect is always interesting, you know, that I've respected from afar. That said, it's very difficult to act with somebody that you respect in that way.
Why?
Because there's a distancing thing that happens. I mean, for example, if you're supposed to, if your lover in the film is an actor that, like, I've watched in movies since, you know, say the early 90s or something like that, after I got out of college, and I have to be intimate with them, they're still going to be kind of in my head from these other movies. And so there's a process that takes, usually I think, a very brief period of time, depending on how willing they are to drop it. It's really up to that person to let go of the... It's empowering to have that kind of respect. And it's up to them to let go of that power in order to act with you.
Who has that happened with?
I've been fortunate. It's happened with a number. You know, with Liam Neeson, it happened with me. Actually, Liam plays, and I play a kind of. We are basically lovers in Kinsey. I mean, his wife is also my lover in the movie, so it's a little bit confusing. But you know, grew up watching Liam Neeson in movies, and he's got this incredible power and charisma as an actor, and it's difficult to imagine that person being your lover if you've seen them in movies for all that length of time. So, but Liam is exactly the kind of guy that lets go of that kind of power the moment you meet him, or, you know, tries to. And then it's up to the two of you to negotiate some new relationship, you know.
Did Sean Penn let go of that power when he was killing you in Dead Man Walking, or did he keep that power so as to better be forceful with you?
Yeah, he kept it. I mean, I think there was no reason for him to let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it absolutely depends on the role. I mean, some of the time it can work to your advantage. Harrison Ford in K-19 never let go of it with me, and it's because he played my commanding officer. And he was the Daddy Warbucks that I had to go talk to when everything was going wrong. And it was much better if he kind of kept that enormous presence that he has. And, you know, all I could do was react to it. So many of the circumstances in that movie were true to life. I'd never been on a nuclear submarine before. My character had never been on a nuclear submarine before, and was asked to be the guy who took care of the heart of the machine, the reactor officer, you know. I'd never been on a $100 million movie before. I'd never acted with, you know, Harrison Ford in this situation. And I was entrusted with a very significant part of the story, you know, the heart of the movie in some ways. And it was incredibly intimidating, and every day was very stressful for me on that movie. But I think it looks right in the film. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Peter Sarsgaard, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Peter Sarsgaard is now starring in the new movie Shattered Glass in the role of Charles Lane, the editor of The New Republic. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews several specials marking the 40th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. This is Fresh Air. November 22nd is the 40th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. To mark the date, various television specials are revisiting that tragic event. TV critic David Bianculli looked at several of these programs and has these thoughts.
What is there left to say, after so many years, about the assassination of John F. Kennedy? As it turns out, a lot. Not only because our perspective keeps changing, but because technology does too. When JFK was shot in Dallas on November 22, 1963, only one person in the crowd of onlookers, Abraham Zapruder, was filming the president as the motorcade was fired upon. Television wasn't there either. Local TV stations in Dallas had provided live coverage of Kennedy's arrival at the airport and were set up to televise his luncheon speech across town, but the president never got there. Ever since then, TV cameras have shadowed the president every moment he's in public view. Even if they're not broadcasting live, networks are present and filming just in case. That's why when Ronald Reagan was shot exiting a Washington luncheon in 1981, footage was available and relayed nationwide almost instantly. And with the millions of personal camcorders out there today, a modern-day tragic event would have not one Zapruder, but hundreds. It happened during 9/11, and many newscasts and documentaries benefited from that amateur footage. 40 years ago, things were different. And a wonderful PBS documentary premiering tonight examines just how different. It's called JFK Breaking the News and looks at the story from a very narrow yet very revealing angle. Walter Cronkite's unforgettable announcement about Kennedy's death is included, but most of this documentary, narrated by Jane Pauley, is about how local media in Dallas covered the story. These print journalists and photographers and radio and TV reporters included such subsequently famous faces as Jim Lehrer of the Dallas Times-Herald and Bob Schieffer of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Radio and TV reporters in Dallas often beat the networks to the punch, going with information as soon as they heard it.
This is an Orlan jacket.
That's right. Look
at 12:30 Friday afternoon, Dallas TV stations were airing regular programming. Live coverage of the president was set to resume when he began making a speech at the Trade Mart.
It should have, and very often you'll find a zipper hidden in the arm.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You'll excuse the fact that I'm out of breath, but about 10 or 15 minutes ago, a tragic thing, from all indications at this point, has happened in the city of Dallas. Let me quote to you this. And you'll excuse me if I am out of breath. A bulletin, this is from the United Press, from Dallas. President Kennedy and Governor John Connally have been cut down by assassin's bullets in downtown Dallas. They were riding in an open automobile when the shots were fired. The president, his limp body carried in the arms of his wife, Jacqueline, has rushed to Parkland Hospital. And if you'll excuse me if I give some directions and we talk about what we're going to do here for the next few minutes, but Bobby, let's tape this, if you please, particularly the interview with the eyewitness people. It is being taped good.
Much of that coverage was quickly fed from Dallas to the national networks, which were moments away from suspending all regular programming for 4 days.
A bulletin from CBS News, President
Kennedy. With no preparation whatsoever, they would undertake the most massive coverage of any event since the invention of television.
By looking at the local rather than national level, Breaking the News manages to see its subject in a new way. So does another documentary tonight. A Court TV forensic files special called The JFK Assassination Investigation Reopened. It looks at two key pieces of evidence, the Zapruder film and an audio tape of sounds recorded from the open mic of a motorcycle cop on the scene that day, and uses the most modern techniques to analyze the trajectories of the bullets. It's like sending the team from CSI on the biggest case of all and having them use state-of-the-art audio analysis and three-dimensional computer imaging to solve the biggest murder case of the 20th century. Did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone? Ultimately, this court TV special says yes. Tomorrow night's two-hour ABC special, Peter Jennings Reporting, The Kennedy Assassination Beyond Conspiracy, uses similar computer imaging techniques and reaches similar conclusions. Only the first portion, examining the Zapruder film, was available for preview. But it's more than compelling enough to recommend the rest.
Dale Myers is a computer animator who has been studying the assassination for more than 25 years. To advance the analysis of the crime, Myers has generated an exacting computer simulation of the Zapruder film. He began by constructing a three-dimensional scale model of Dealey Plaza, the turn from Houston Street onto Elm Street, the Texas School Book Depository, the grassy knoll. They are all reconstructed exactly the way they were in 1963. He then animated the movements of President Kennedy and Governor Connally over the Zapruder film, frame by frame. When all of these elements come together, we can now leave the place where Zapruder was filming and see the shooting from any point of view, each one an accurate representation of precisely what happened. If the crime were committed today, forensic investigators would unquestionably use this technique.
Other JFK specials take different angles. Last week's History Channel documentary, JFK: A Presidency Revealed, looked not at his death, but at his political achievements. Tomorrow's repeat of Who Was Lee Harvey Oswald on the PBS series Frontline offers another look at a fascinating biography first shown 10 years ago. And there are other TV reports as well, most of them very worthwhile. TV came of age the day Kennedy was shot and seems to continue to rise to the occasion whenever revisiting the subject. Mythologist Joseph Campbell called the original days of TV coverage of the assassination and funeral of JFK and the murder of Oswald a deeply significant rite of passage for the entire country. A few weeks after the assassination, TV Guide printed a letter that said it all. On that unforgettable weekend in 1963, the letter read, television provided a personal experience which all could share, a vast religious service which all could attend, a unifying bond which all could feel. I take this opportunity to add my voice to those who already have recognized television's historic contribution. The letter was signed, Lyndon B. Johnson, President of the United States. 4 decades later, with documentaries like the ones this week, TV is still contributing.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Starbucks, makers of eggnog lattes, peppermint mochas, and gingerbread lattes, available this holiday season at Starbucks, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, publisher of Sickened, the memoir of a Munchausen by proxy childhood by Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we have a great show for me to poop on. At least that's what our guest Triumph the Insult Comic Dog would say. He's been insulting celebrities on Conan O'Brien's show for years. Now he has a new CD. Also, we meet the man behind the rubber puppet dog, Robert Smigel. Join us for the next Fresh Air.